everyone. I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Matt Smith.
And we are historians.
Wait, well, that's not right.
One of us is anyway.
Yeah, okay.
If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to Season 6 of Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
Why do you sound like you're selling a used car, Matt? We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, I am once again stepping out from behind the producer desk as we reconvene at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University on unceded Wurundjeri land to welcome a guest who needs little introduction. Eve Rees is a historian, writer, and fellow podcaster who for the past 6 years has been co-host of this venerable podcast. They have been shortlisted for and won a number of awards, including the 2020 Caliber Essay Prize, has authored a memoir titled All About Eve, and is a respected expert on transgender history and politics. Their most recent book, Travelling to Tomorrow, The Modern Women Who Sparked Australia's Romance with America, has received from esteemed historian Claire Wright the following accolade. You will want to meet these fearless and feisty women. Rees gives us their stories in full-bodied, hot-blooded fashion. Welcome to the podcast, Eve.
Thank you so much for having me on this venerable podcast.
Venerable means old, doesn't it?
Respected?
I always think it like old and respected.
Yeah,
that's all right. I'm going with that.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Eve, to begin this podcast, I want to take you back to the early days of Archive Fever and to how you have thought about archives since then. How has your perception changed about how you think about archives and what they mean to you?
I think the biggest thing I've learned across the 6 seasons of Archive Fever we've done is that archives are not neutral spaces. I think, you know, like Claire, as a white middle-class settler historian, I had quite a romantic, fond view of archives as these kind of treasure troves where people like me went in and kind of opened lots of boxes and went on a fun detective hunt and found exciting facts about the past. And, you know, looking back, that feels incredibly naive because, you know, we've had many sorts of guests on this podcast over the 6 seasons, but I think guests that have been particularly impactful for me have been the many First Nations creatives, thinkers, scholars we've had on who've really made me see and understand how archives on this continent are not just kind of repositories that contain evidence of the colonial project in Australia. They're actually highly political spaces that are actively contributing to the violence of colonisation in the present. I'm reminded here of the famous Patrick Wolfe phrase in his theorisation of settler colonialism, and he infamously said that colonialism is not an event, it's a process. And I think we can see the ongoing process of colonisation in so many sites in contemporary Australia. But one of them is in archives, in the way in which they record a white history of this country, the way in which they record these incredibly racialised, dehumanising depictions of First Nations people, and the way in which that access to those spaces is still really fraught and often traumatic for First Nations people trying to engage with their own family history and the history of this continent. So I guess I have a much more sceptical, critical, kind of wary relationship to archives now than I did 6 years ago. But I also kind of think they're more interesting as a result of seeing them as kind of active places that are kind of, you know, powerful political actors in the present rather than just kind of dead neutral spaces that just kind of have a lot of documents piled up. I guess I've developed a really strong interest in the glam sector and how museums, libraries, archives, etc., can be decolonizing their practices in the present. And this semester in my teaching at La Trobe University, I've been teaching an honours level subject exactly about these questions, about archives and the way they shape historical knowledge and storytelling and the way they continue to be violent spaces or not in the present. And that subject has come sort of directly out of the thinking that Archive Fever has prompted in me.
And so every year, I guess this is a question for both of you in a way, when you sit down and plan out a new series of Archive Fever, do you go, what's next? What can we still teach people about how they need to rethink archives?
I think it is partly a process that comes from the development of our thinking, that we are being pushed each season to think about archives in more critical ways and more creative ways. I also think the broader culture has shifted hugely in the last 6 years. It's been a time of, I was going to say a time of incredible creativity among First Nations people. I think that's actually incorrect. I think First Nations people have always been speaking and producing work in really creative, innovative ways. I think what's shifted is perhaps that the white publishing industry and white audiences are perhaps getting a tiny bit better at listening. And so there has been this sort of surge of writing from people like Evelyn Araluen, Jazz Money, Crystal DiNapoli, a kind of younger generation of First Nations thinkers, challenging us to think about how knowledge is produced and stored in critical and creative ways. And in some ways, I see me and Claire in this podcast as we're just kind of trying to keep up with that really interesting thinking that's been done. I saw just this week that the Gamilaroi thinker J.M. Field has just signed a contract with University of Queensland Press to publish a book of essays that will come out in 2025 about Gamilaroi ways of being and knowing. And I was like, oh, we've got to get them on the podcast next year. And I just have this sense that there's all this amazing work being produced, and it's just such a kind of privilege and honour to try and get our kind of basic bitch white brains to get a little bit of an insight into the complexity of First Nations thought.
In terms of the curation of the series as well, just sort of the nuts and bolts of it, we also try to present a mix to make sure that the series is inclusive. So we're always looking for ideas. We put them in a kind of a matrix as we're going along through the year, and then sit down at the beginning of a season and kind of flesh out what a good season might look like. We're also now pitched a lot of books from publishing companies. We don't set out to teach anybody anything, but I think there are a lot of people whose ears are pricked up around the idea of archives now after this season. So publishing companies in particular, when they're trying to work out where they can place their new products, anybody who's doing any interesting research, they send our way.
And I think that's also reflective of changing dynamics in publishing and promotion, I guess. In the absence of traditional print media and the declining space for reviews in print media, that podcasts are becoming such an important vehicle for people to spread the word about new books and new culture.
Speaking about new books and new culture, shall we delve into Travelling to Tomorrow?
Let's travel there.
That's such a nice segue, man.
I know. In the opening of your book, you describe how inspiration was drawn from your own journey and experiences in America, contrasted by what most of white Australia see as a more traditional pilgrimage back to the UK. Can you tell us about some of the women of your story and what were they searching for by travelling to America?
Thanks, Matt. So this book, Travelling to Tomorrow, tells the story of 10 modern Australian women who ventured to the United States for work, study and adventure in the early decades of the 20th century. The book starts in 1910 and goes up to the 1960s, but most of the action is set in the 1920s and 30s. And in this book, I'm really, I guess, kind of doing two things. I'm telling the story of these really extraordinary modern women who are often pioneering figures in particular professions and did this extraordinary thing of travelling overseas and to America, no less, this quite, for the time, obscure destination at a time when relatively few people and especially women were travelling. But I'm also using these women to make an argument, a kind of a feminist interventionist argument about the history of international relations and particularly the Australian-US relationship. When we talk about this relationship, we so often talk about it in terms of the military alliance between Australia and the US and the formal treaties that went alongside that. So fighting together in the Pacific in World War II and then the ANZUS Treaty, which emerged in the 1950s and kind of built this special relationship that continues on to the current day. And that's all true and a real part of that history. But I'm sort of saying relations between nations don't just happen between official diplomats. They also happen in the realm of culture and travel. And so I'm suggesting that these women were actually kind of pioneering figures in drawing Australia and America closer together and helping to kind of lay a cultural foundation for this kind of more formal diplomatic ties that emerged in the mid-20th century. Now, in terms of who these women actually were, I mean, they were all sorts. The first woman I came upon who got me into this project was the artist Mary Cecil Allen, who was a modernist artist who was a sort of darling of the Melbourne art scene in the 1920s, who went to New York to lecture in the late 20s and basically just stayed because why wouldn't you stay in New York in the late 1920s? It was all happening there. She was living in Bohemian Greenwich Village. She was hanging out with the big modernist artists of her day and, you know, having this quiet kind of fun bohemian life of extramarital affairs and so on. And so I first studied this woman, Mary Cecil Allen, and she kind of led me to think, God, this was a bit of an unusual path for a woman to go to America in the 1920s, at the time when most women, if they were going overseas, were going to London. You know, I wonder if there's any other women like her. What I found was that there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. The initial version of this project, I had about 700 women I looked at who went from Australia to America for work or study in this time. And they worked across all sorts of professions. They worked in the film industry. They were actors. They were novelists. They were dentists. They were nurses. They were early childcare teachers, all sorts. But the kind of unifying pull across all these different women and careers was the tug of modernity. For all of them, America seemed like the future, hence the title, Travelling to Tomorrow. It seemed like a place that was home to the most cutting edge ideas and practice, both in their own kind of individual professions, but also just in the question of how to live. America seemed like a place that had more modern attitudes in terms of women's role, you know, in things like architecture, in fashions, in the technology of everyday life. So there was consistently across these very different women and experiences a real sense of romance and seduction about this kind of glittering tomorrow that America represented to them.
Mm. Is this something that you were relating to at the time when you went over there in your youth?
Absolutely, absolutely.
In your youth.
I'm so old now.
Sorry.
I'd gone, after I finished my undergraduate degree at the University of Melbourne, I'd travelled to London, like a good little colonial, to do my master's degree. And like so many generations of white Australians before me, I'd sort of thought of this as a homecoming. You know, I was going back to the mother country to get some spit and polish in the homeland. You know, I'd gone to this colonial university, the University of Melbourne, but I was going to get the real deal at University College London. That was sort of my internal narrative. And then I got to London and it was really, really underwhelming. You know, the education I received was no better. The standards were no higher than I'd received in Melbourne. The city was grey and cold and kind of felt culturally foreign and alienating. And it generally just sort of felt a bit limp and lackluster. Like it felt like a kind of low energy place in a way that I found kind of alienating and a bit depressing, to be honest. And then I contrasted that with about a year later, my then partner had an internship to work in Silicon Valley in the tech industry south of San Francisco. So we went over and lived in San Francisco for many months. San Francisco kind of proved to be the exciting metropolis I thought I was going to find in London. It felt like this place of incredible energy and excitement and modernity again. And I guess my own experience of the contrast between these two got me interested as well in thinking about Australians historically who might have gravitated towards London because they'd been acculturated to think of it as their homeland, but actually found more kind of resonance in the US. But of course, I mean, it's also important to flag that this shiny idea of America is also a fantasy. And, you know, America's been very good at selling this idea of itself to Americans and the world as part of its imperial project. But that seductive vision of a streamlined modern America is a kind of facade that hides the violent, colonial, extractive, militaristic America that very much existed in the period I'm looking at and still is causing havoc in the world today.
Eve, can you tell us a bit about the archives that you used to do this research? So I'm imagining you yourself had to be in America working through American archival collections. And also, was your whole experience of doing that archival research different in America from what you had experienced in either the UK or Australia?
So I did spend a lot of time in US archives. I spent a semester in the US towards the beginning of this research project. I was based at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and travelled all around the country. And I also then went back to the US for many subsequent research trips. Though I should say I also, a lot of my research took place in Australia because one big part of this story is that so many of these Australian women wanted to stay in America because they'd fallen in love with it, but forces conspired to bring them back to Australia and most of them died in Australia. So what papers remained kind of ended up here. One really interesting point of comparison between my Australian research and my US research is, I mean, in general, the women in this book had been kind of forgotten. I sort of talk about them falling between the cracks of two national histories because they left Australia, but they weren't quite American either. But they were also better remembered in American popular memory and American institutions. A number of the women in this book, I'm thinking of the economist, Persia Campbell, who became a really important economic advisor to several US presidents and to the United Nations. In Australia, no one has heard of her aside from, you know, like five feminist historians across the country. And there's sort of almost nothing about her in any archives nationwide. But in the US, there is this huge personal archive dedicated to her life and career. And she is reasonably well remembered. I had one occasion in which I was there on a research trip and went to a bar one evening, got chatting with a random bloke at the bar next to me. He asked me what I was doing there. And I mentioned my research project and mentioned the name Persia Campbell. You know, young 20-something white guy. I was like, oh, yeah, of course I know about Persia Campbell. Like, I did an undergraduate economics degree and we studied her work. And that just kind of blew my mind because I've spoken to a lot of people who've done economics degrees in Australia and none of them have heard of Persia Campbell. So there was a much greater degree of remembering of these women in the US. And I think that's kind of revealing about Australia's really conflicted relationship with the kind of international stage, that we have this cultural cringe. We desperately want, you know, our fellow Australians to prove it internationally, to show we have the chops to make it on the world stage. So many of us individually feel like we need to go overseas to prove ourselves. But when Australians do go overseas, there's this kind of weird resentment and sense of betrayal that crops up, this sense of like, how dare you go off to London or New York or Los Angeles and forget about us? You know, you've betrayed us. You're too big for your boots now. Tall poppy syndrome kicks in as well alongside the cultural cringe. And there can also be this kind of thinly veiled hostility towards Australians who've been successful overseas. And I think our failure to remember this cohort of Australians reflects that hostility.
That's so interesting. As you're speaking, I'm thinking of Germaine Greer, who would be a more modern example. But sometimes that's because Germain criticizes Australia. These women, were they critical of the Australia they looked back on, and did they see it as being part of some kind of not only colonial but a past that they wanted to move out of towards this modernist future?
Absolutely. You know, as I mentioned a moment ago, so many of them came back to Australia because they ran out of money or they got sick or their parents got sick and they were meant to be the dutiful single daughter who came back and looked after their elderly parents, which was kind of a personal grief for a lot of these women. But it meant they then had the opportunity to kind of import all these modern ideas they'd been exposed to in America. And they did that, often to great effect, but it often involved being very, very critical of the status quo of how things were done in Australia. They were sort of early disruptors in a way, that they came back into this very British, very masculinist culture that had been quite complacent and very happy to do things that had always been done. And these women kind of often just like lit a fuse under that culture in many different contexts and said, this is not good enough. Like, I've seen what's happening in New York. It's different and it's better and we're so behind the times and we need to get our shit together. And in many cases that did enact real change, but not without considerable pushback. So often male gatekeepers in particular professions would treat them with enormous hostility. One slightly trivial example of this is the wellness influencer Alice Capehorn, who was this slightly kind of cuckoo early adherent of naturopathy and veganism and nudism and a kind of, you know, alternative wellness kind of space in the 20s and 30s in the US. And then she came back to Perth in the late 1930s and sort of went on this one-woman mission to sort of introduce health foods and veganism to Perth. All of Australia was pretty conservative and isolated in the late 30s, but Perth was especially the case. Then there's this, you know, kind of modern woman saying, drink almond milk because cow's milk is actually terrible for you and you should drink almond milk and vegetable juices and brown bread and nuts and seeds. The local medical establishment just lost their shit. They felt so threatened by this woman coming in and questioning their medical orthodoxy, which was that cow's milk was essential to human nutrition and well-being. And they went on this kind of incredibly, kind of almost comically hyperbolic smear campaign against this woman who was just walking around telling people to drink almond milk. She was effectively the 1937 version of cancelled. They had newspaper after newspaper headline that she was this kind of Yankee hack who didn't know what she was talking about. She was setting out to kind of undermine the health of the nation and was basically a threat to public health and sanity.
Burn her.
Yeah, she was the witch completely. And I mean, it's, you know, that's a kind of silly example, but that kind of dynamic repeated in almost any professional context. This is a story about America and modernity and a sort of transnational history, but it's also a story that's very revealing of just the intense misogyny of Australia at this time and, you know, arguably still today.
Eve, your book had an origin story as your PhD, and your interests and your research has evolved in that time, and many would associate you with queer and gender history. So can you tell us about how you thought about your earlier work when you came to approach it for publication? I have a habit of looking back on something that I wrote a decade ago and absolutely cringing. Did you go through this process? Did you reevaluate what you wrote? Did you wish that you delved into archives looking for different answers?
I mean, I think any person who's growing as a professional cringes at work they did a decade ago. I'd be worried if you didn't. I guess for me, my journey with the evolution of this project was that I, as you say, had started this research as a PhD, and then as a kind of rule-following type A early career academic, was planning to sort of follow the laws of academia, the rules of academia, and publish my PhD as an academic monograph with a very prestigious academic press. So that would involve, you know, revising the manuscript a bit as a book, but essentially keeping it as a very dense product designed to be read by other academics. And, you know, if it's published by an academic press, it's often quite expensive. books can be upwards of $100 a copy, so it's not affordable for the average punter. It's just something that gets bought by university libraries. So a very specific type of product. But that's what I'd been told you had to do to make it as a historian. And then life intervened and I realised that I was trans, and I wrote the memoir that you mentioned in the introduction, All About Eve, which was a memoir written for a general audience, which, you know, led me to do lots of media interviews and podcast interviews and go to writers' festivals and speak to non-academic audiences. And I really, really liked it. I was like, wow, isn't it amazing to talk about ideas and history, because there was some trans history in that book, to people outside of the university. These people are really hungry for ideas. They're really smart. They're really engaged. And I feel like I'm actually making a difference, that my skills I've learned in a university context are actually affecting the world in a way that I don't feel when I'm writing for other academics. So I kind of, you know, drank the Kool-Aid of writing for a bigger audience, and then thought, what if I took this research about Australian women in America and didn't publish it as an academic monograph? What if I wrote it up for a general audience? Because there's some bloody good stories in here. These women deserve to have their stories told. I want to contribute to this bigger project that Claire and many other people have been part of writing women and their agency back into Australian history, because they were always there. They've just kind of been written out of it. And I can only really do that effectively in a way that will change the broader culture if I write a kind of more narrative-based trade history, as they're known, for a general readership. So that's what I decided to do. When I made that decision, I think I was really naive about how long that would take. I was like, oh yeah, I've done all the research already. It'll just take a few months to switch it up. It actually took several years, because I completely rewrote this project. I had to do a lot more research on certain topics, particularly the women I chose to highlight, because the initial PhD version had 700 characters. And for this published book, I focused in on 10 women. So I needed to kind of bulk out my research on those 10 women. But writing it in this more narrative way was actually just such a joy. Like, it was time consuming. It took more than a few months. But it felt like being let off the leash and being able to kind of tell the story of these characters in my authentic voice, in a voice that I knew would be engaging and honour their memory. So it was actually so much fun to do.
Eve, you said you went back and did more research in the transition from your book being a scholarly PhD book for a trade audience, but you'd also transitioned yourself during that period. I wonder whether when you went back to the archives, you went with a different set of questions because of your new experience as now a trans person. Did you look for clues for experiences those women might have had that you wouldn't have looked for previously, because you were kind of seeing the world through different eyes?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, one of the reasons why I'd been slow to publish my PhD as a book when I was still in its academic monograph iteration was that when I came out as trans, I had this kind of crisis about doing women's history. I was like, you know, if I'm not a woman, should I be doing women's history? Is this my history? Are these women in the past my forebears? Am I part of this lineage? How do I relate to them? So I kind of went on this angst spiral about all those questions and felt like I needed to put that project to the side for a number of years. And so for several years, I was still publishing history, but I was writing about completely different stuff. I was writing about the history of the economics profession and capitalism and migration. And when I finally came back to this project, I guess I was still grappling with those questions of, as a not woman, how do I situate myself to these historical women? Because I had initially really approached them from a place of identification. And now I'm sort of thinking, well, what is my relationship? If we're not the same, what's going on there? But then I went back to the archives for individual women that I focused on in this book, the kind of the core 10. And as you've kind of gestured towards, Claire, I did have new eyes and I saw new things. I realised that I'd been a bit naive in thinking that these characters are all just women in the past. Of course, they were all female assigned people who lived in the world as women. They probably would have thought of themselves as women. But when you kind of look at their lives and their archives through a trans queer lens, there's so much gender non-conforming stuff going on there. Because, of course, these were all individuals who really pushed against the gender norms of their time. You know, they were women who mainly didn't marry, who had careers, who travelled overseas. So they're kind of already living on the edge of acceptable womanhood. But in addition to that, so many of them were kind of inhabiting a sort of androgyny or even a masculinity that we would now probably describe as non-binary or genderqueer or kind of a sort of proto-trans way of being in the world. So, for instance, Mary Cecil Allen, the artist who first got me into this project, in Australia she'd been mainly known as Mary Allen. And then when she moved to New York, she started using her middle name Cecil and was Mary Cecil Allen. But then over time, towards the later stages of her career, she just wanted to be known as Cecil, like the male name Cecil. So she's wearing pants, going around with short hair, known as Cecil, living in these very queer neighbourhoods. There's a few red flags here that this is not a kind of conventional cishet individual. That just kept happening again and again. Like many of the other characters had kind of masculine surnames. One had chest reduction surgery in the 1930s, which, you know, struck me as, in a way, a kind of early form of the top surgery I had 3 years ago to remove my breasts. Another character, the novelist Dorothy Cottrell, wrote an autobiographical novel where one of the characters talks at length, has this monologue about feeling not quite like a man and not quite like a woman, but like they're that kind of mix of the two sexes' energies combined. And when I read this about 2 years ago, my jaw almost dropped because I thought, God, this is like a perfect articulation of what we would now call a kind of non-binary gender identity, but it was written in 1927. So long story short, absolutely, I began to look at these women anew through a trans and queer lens and realised that perhaps it wasn't the case that I was trans and they were women. Perhaps we were all just female assigned people with complex gender stuff going on, using the concepts available to us in our context to survive and thrive.
Eve, I understand from your colourful Instagram presence that you are now working on a history of drag in Australia. Can you tell us about this process? What interests you about the topic? And are you in the process of building and developing a new archive that maybe didn't exist before?
Absolutely. So having finished this project about Australian women in America, I've sort of been on the hunt for a new big project that's going to be my next book and occupy me for the next couple of years. And I knew I really wanted to do something in Australian queer history because it's still a really vastly under-researched field. And as a queer and trans person myself, I know how queer history is like food for queer people. Like, it's just so sustaining to have this sense of a kind of tangible past, of a tangible lineage, a sense that we're real, we've always been here. I wanted to give that nourishment to my community. I'm very conscious of being one of relatively few academic, you know, full-time employed queer historians in this country. So I really wanted to use those resources and that privilege to give back to the queer community. And then I was sort of thinking over what of the various queer topics to research I could land on. And I guess I was drawn to drag history because it's a really joyful, creative history. And a lot of queer and trans history, you know, is quite traumatic and difficult and painful. That felt like a heavy thing to be putting myself into for the next few years. But also I guess I worry that telling those more traumatic stories can sort of emphasize what often gets called like deficit narratives of queerness, this sense that we're a bit broken, we're a bit flawed, we're all sort of suicidal and depressed and these kind of husks of people. I worried that focusing on the trauma too much would reinforce that story. So I wanted to tell a queer history that was a history that still has dark aspects to it, but is a history of vibrancy and living out loud and making and sharing and community, which is very much what drag is all about.
I understand that one of your chief archival sources for the project so far has been RuPaul's Drag Race. Can you tell me about the experience of, instead of going to a bricks and mortar institution and sitting down there with your archives, turning on the television and binging RuPaul?
I mean, I wouldn't say quite an archive, Claire. I'd probably say a useful contextualization, because perhaps this is preempting my dirty little archive secret, but I was a fan of drag starting this project, but I hadn't actually watched any RuPaul's Drag Race. I'd seen live drag shows and loved them, but no Drag Race. I mentioned to some queer friends, I was like, oh yeah, I'll need to like spend a good week, you know, catching up on Drag Race. And they were like, Eve, do you have any idea how many series of Drag Race there are? You won't need a week. You'll need a year at least. And then I looked into it and realized, yes, there are like 19 or so series of the main RuPaul plus endless spin-off series in particular countries and all-stars and et cetera. I have been watching a lot of RuPaul over the last few months. I still have a lot more to go. But it has been this fascinating kind of immersion in trans cultures. And particularly it's been fascinating seeing the so far three seasons of RuPaul Drag Race Down Under, which was the Australian franchise which started in 2021. To look at, I suppose, the contrast between Australian drag cultures, which tend to be very kind of earthy, a bit bawdy, quite ochre, and the much more kind of polished pageantry style drag that flourishes in the US, that RuPaul kind of exports in Drag Race. So I think seeing the mismatch between RuPaul's Drag Race and Australian drag and the way in which that local franchise actually didn't quite work has made me actually learn a huge amount of what makes Australian drag distinctive on the world stage.
And you also went to the Broken Heel Festival this year, which Matt might be referring to as your colourful Instagram page.
Yeah, well, it was very onerous. So part of the great suffering I've been having to do for this research project is go to drag festivals. I mean, talk about deep in the trenches of on the front lines of research. So there are many good reasons to be doing drag history now in this country. But one of them is it's the 30th anniversary of Priscilla, the Queen of the Desert, the iconic Australian film that came out in 1994. So there's a lot of drag discourse and commemoration and conversation going on, but yet still no good survey at drag history, which is why I'm doing it. But as part of this commemoration, there was a huge festival in Broken Hill, the outback town in New South Wales, where most of the film of Priscilla was filmed. And for the past 9 years, the town of Broken Hill has hosted this drag festival called Broken Heel, heel as in high heel, celebrating the town's role in Australian drag history and drag cultures. And it was an extra big festival this year for the 30th anniversary. But it was also the last festival. The organisers have said they're not going to do it anymore because it's too much work and they need a break. So I was like, this needs to be documented. So I hot-footed it to Broken Heel and recorded a lot of interviews and audio and found some amazing stories. And I'm actually making my own podcast about the Broken Heel Festival. So watch this space.
So, Eve, it sounds like in the process of going to Broken Heel for research, you're actually building your own drag archive out of those oral history interviews that you've been doing.
Absolutely. And that's just the beginning. Part of the research I want to be doing over the next few years is to be doing a really comprehensive kind of oral history project of contemporary and former drag artists all over the country. So many of the great names of Australia's post-war heyday of drag in the 1960s and 70s are still alive and kicking. So kind of now is the perfect moment to be recording their memories. Because it's a sort of subcultural, often quite an ephemeral art form, I really want to kind of get their memories down and hopefully donate this collection of oral histories to an archive like the Australian Queer Archives in Melbourne or the National Library of Australia in Canberra. You know, many listeners will know that in the 1960s, there was a phenomenon in King's Cross called Lay Girls, this kind of very popular all-male review, as it was called. And Lay Girls was credited with mainstreaming drags, that, it, you know, straight couples from the suburbs would come in to King's Cross for dinner and a show and were therefore kind of exposed to the joys of drag. And Carlotta was one of the original cast members of Lay Girls and became a national celebrity and spent many decades in Australian media. And she's still very much alive and kicking and is, in fact, still working. So it's so important to capture the voices of people like Carlotta and that generation to be recorded as part of our national heritage.
So is this a kind of a shout out? Like, do you have a list of people you want to interview? Or if somebody who has been part of this great heritage of drag in Australia but has never spoken out about it, wants to get in touch with you, should they do that?
Absolutely. I mean, I do have a list, but it's ever growing and I want it to keep growing because I'm still at the early stages of this project and I don't know what I don't know. I'm particularly interested in uncovering drag communities outside Sydney and Melbourne, which I know are really vibrant, but, you know, there's been less collected and written about them. So please email me at eve.rees@latrobe.edu.au to tell me who I should interview and why.
You sound like you are completely in the grip of the fever at the moment, Eve.
I am so in the fever. It is so much fun. And I could talk about this for the next hour, but I will say that I think drag is really exciting for me because it's a safe space for mainstream culture, for straights to kind of get a little taste of queerness and a taste of gender exploration, gender experimentation, gender transgression. So I guess I'm really excited about it as a kind of site of interface between the straight world and the queer world. It's a kind of like a carnivale type context where things that are normally forbidden become allowed in a particular time and place. And I think that's just really thrilling to see what happens when people are given the chance to experiment and explore.
Well, your fever is absolutely infectious and I can't wait to see what you're going to do next as well. But that's all we've got time for on the podcast today. So thank you so much, Eve, for jumping onto the other side of the desk and being on Archive Fever. Thank you, Matt, for co-hosting. It's been super fun.
Thank you. That's all the time we've got for the podcast today. You can find out more about Eve's book, Travelling to Tomorrow, as well as their previous works, including their memoir, All About Eve, at their website, everees.com, and you can follow them on Instagram at eve_rees. You can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Matt on Twitter at Nightlight Guy. Don't forget that you can catch up on all 5 previous seasons of Archive Fever via the website archivefeverpod.com. You can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to listen.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Matt Smith.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you have been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by yours truly on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.